Yes, said Officer Mundy, seated at the small table that acted as a podium when required. Six had stood in front of it. I thought it was necessary to explain, so that Resident Jimenez wouldn't worry. In the event, she looked up from her data unit. I won't say she was smiling, but her expression was as positive as I'd ever seen it. I got the impression that he hadn't understood that there might have been a problem. Oh, one more thing, Ofetri, Six said. I won't be leaving any of the warrant officers, and certainly not Wochen's. Understood, sir. I suspect I'll be able to assess most units here without expert help, though I may take the rest of the detachment along just to give them something to do. I've never noticed that spacers had trouble finding things to do in a city, Six said, smiling again. But it might be just as well to keep your people close if you're going to be wandering here and there. At any rate, you're dismissed until the meeting here at 1600 hours. I'll make the final assignments then. And Ofetri? Sir? Thanks for helping me out of the hole I was digging for myself with Ennery. Sir, I said, I'm honored that you think of me as part of your team. I saluted and went off. Mostly I was thinking of the opportunity I'd thrown away, but at the back of my mind, I knew that I'd be seeing Monica shortly. I stood with my five spacers on the porch of the naval building, watching the destroyers of the 7th Flotilla rise to orbit one at a time. There'd never been more than six in the military harbor at the same time, but there were two more in powered orbit. There'd been an exchange every couple hours to top off reaction mass. Where are they off to first? Mixon asked, while the echoes of the quail faded as she climbed. Lauren, I said. Mixon didn't need to know any more than I had, but the flotilla would arrive before any Karst spy could get word there. There's usually a Karst naval presence in the system, a couple gunboats and maybe a destroyer, and a great deal of civilian traffic. Weddell and Gamba were the only members of my crew whom I really knew, but Mixon, Gadient, and Tyler were able spacers whom any captain would want in his crew. None of them had volunteered to stay on Segundum, but neither had they complained about the assignment. I had no intention of being the sort of superior who concealed information just because he could. They going to capture the place? Gamba asked. Dunno, I said. I guess it depends on how the locals react. I don't think the flotilla's got any ground troops embarked, but if the Karst governor wants to roll on his back and kick his legs in the air, I guess Six would oblige him, wouldn't you? The quail had been the last of the flotilla. I looked at my people and said, well, I don't think they're coming back down to ask our help, so let's get cracking. I think that, I pointed to the long brick building at the westernmost cape of the harbor, is the naval arsenal. I figure we can check it out before supper, right? We set off along the harbor road without bothering with our vehicle. It was late afternoon when we returned to the residency after going over the arsenal. 12 of the 14 staff had actually been on duty, and I didn't know that you'd do a lot better in a similar RCN facility. I hadn't seen any sign of overbuying to please a brother-in-law or the like. The like, in this case, meaning a Seguntine Dean Ofetri with a backhander. The most expensive items were munitions for the dart sloops. There were 7 in store, and the sloops hadn't been reloaded since the Karst raid. The darts were manufactured on Pantelleria, and probably couldn't be replaced in under 6 months' time. I wonder if ground-launched anti-ship missiles can be adapted to the sloops, I said to Gamba. Are we going to need more, he said, frowning. He looked back over his shoulder toward the building we just left. I don't know, I said, and it's not our job at the moment. But what's the difference besides the more energetic first-stage propellant? I guess we can check the dimensions of the sloop cradles, Weddell said. They eyeball about the same, and I'll bet we could butcher something together that'd work if we could get the use of some tools. We paused at the entrance to the building. The crew was watching me expectantly. I grinned and said, all right. You're all released until 0800 tomorrow. Sir, can we take the car? Gadian said. My instant reaction was no, but the word didn't reach my lips. These weren't young tearaways, and they weren't old lags with long histories of punishment on every ship they'd served on. Aloud, I said, who can drive? I can, said Gadian, and I think Gamba, too. And me, said Weddell. All right, I said, but 0800, don't forget. We're going out to the training facility at ours. We went inside to shower and change. I was heading to the Folliot House for dinner, though I intended to return here to sleep, given the early start I wanted tomorrow. The civilian vehicle would be cramped with 6 of us, and I wondered if I could borrow something bigger from the Director of Public Safety. I had time, though. I took a deep breath and headed for the opposite wing of the building. The Karst mission had three cells in the basement. I didn't know what they'd been intended for, but now the only occupied one held Maeve Grimaud. A desk in the small lobby at the base of the elevator acted as the guard room. The special policeman sitting there at a desktop console couldn't see the cells, which were around a corner. "Good evening," I said. "I'm..." "I know who you are, sir," the policeman said, smiling as he rose. His name tape read, "Bernotti." "I followed you and the colonel up the stairs in Salon. You were having a lot easier time with them than I was." I reached over the desk and shook his hand. "I can't say I remember much of that climb, Sergeant Bernotti," I said, "because I was too bloody scared to think." I cleared my throat. "I'm here to see the prisoner," I said. "I'm the ranking RCN officer on Saguntum now." That was edging the truth a little. I didn't think that signing on to the Sunray put me technically in the RCN, but it was unlikely that anybody here would argue about it. "Sure," Bernotti said, slinging the submachine gun which had leaned against the desk. He took a chip key from a desk drawer and led me to the angle in the hall. "You see how they built these? The guy at the desk can't see what's going on in the cells. If you like, I won't hear nothing either till you're ready to come out." "I won't be doing anything private," I said, smiling pleasantly at him. In fact, the suggestion, I don't know whether he thought I was going to rape Maeve or torture her, made me queasy. Still, the offer was well meant. The cells had barred fronts. Maeve was in the middle, the only one occupied. She'd risen, apparently alerted by the sound of voices. When I came into sight, she smiled and said, "Roy, I certainly didn't expect to see you." "Do you want to go in?" Bernotti asked. "Or you can talk through the bars." "I'll go in," I said. There was a bed, a chair, both steel stampings, much like those of a starship, and a closed chest with a padded top. There was no wardrobe. "Sergeant," I said. Maeve was wearing the clothes she'd been captured in. "What happened to her luggage?" "There's stuff in the storage room out by the desk," Bernotti said. "She can have something if she wants it." He made a face and said, "Look, sir, I guess it's up to you, but I'd sure rather you not take that gun into the cell with you." "Sorry, Bernotti," I said. I kept my voice calm, but from the way my face felt, I was blushing. I pulled the pistol from my cargo pocket and handed it over butt first. I'd forgotten about it. "It's good to be careful in these times," the sergeant said as he transferred the weapon to his own pocket. "You've got more call than most. From what I hear, you saved the old man's ass when those scuts from Karst tried to take him out a couple weeks ago." He opened the door. I stepped in and heard him lock it behind me. "Welcome to my room," Maeve said. She looked more fine-drawn than she had when I'd last seen her. I wondered what she was being fed. "Have you come to tell me I'm a terrible person, or do you just want me to apologize for trying to have you killed?" "Well," I said, "I do apologize," Maeve said, "but I swear to heaven I didn't have any idea you'd be with Folliot. I didn't even know for certain there'd be an attack. I'm sure you've read all my communications with McKinnon, and you know he didn't share his plans with me." I seated myself on the chair and adjusted it slightly to face her squarely. "I don't doubt Lady Mundy's seen everything you say and more, but," I smiled wryly, remembering another discussion with Maeve, "that's above my pay grade. What I've really come to do is release you. But first I've got to explain some things." Maeve sat down on the edge of her bed. "Now you've surprised me again, Roy," she said. Her face was expressionless, but I had the feeling that her nerves were quivering under the skin. "Go on, please." "According to Lady Mundy," I said. I believe the underlying facts were true, but I was saying only what I personally knew. "There has been a secret compact between the Alliance and Cinnabar, approved by Guarantor Pora on the Alliance side and the Cabinet on ours. The Alliance was permitted to absorb the Tarbell stars. In exchange, we were granted a free hand with the hegemony of Karst. The compact leaves in place the Treaty of Amiens and the truce." "If that was true," Maeve said. She paused and looked me straight in the eyes. "If that was true, why is it a secret?" "You'd have to ask somebody else about that," I said. I thought it was pretty likely that the Cabinet hadn't wanted to alert the Karst authorities as to what was about to happen to them, but that was a guess. I do know that the Tarbell stars accepted the friendship of the Alliance last year, and that the Cinnabar Senate didn't object. "Yes," said Maeve, "your information is self-consistent." no emotion in her voice. She leaned back slightly. I said, I don't know much information you've gotten. I gestured generally around the cell. But Cinnabar is openly at war with Karst now. It doesn't seem to me that there's any further reason for you to be locked up. Would Lady Mundy agree? Maeve said, tossing her head dismissively. Dunno, I said. I shrugged. For the time being, I'm the highest-ranking member of the Sunray's company on Saguntum. I'm pretty sure that you've got the resources to get off-planet, and probably back to Cinnabar before Lady Mundy returns. If not, I can find you some help. I'd be better off in this cell than on Cinnabar, Maeve said. She stood up suddenly and walked to the cell door, putting her back to me. I'm a real embarrassment to my superiors. If you're worried about what I'll say at a hearing, I said, don't be. And I really doubt that anything Lady Mundy knows is going to make it back to the Foreign Ministry. There obviously isn't a lot of information passing between the two groups. Maeve turned with a furious expression. It's not that, she said. The people who tasked me know exactly what they ordered me to do, and how wrong-headed they appear to have been. It's not what I did that they want to hide, it's what they did, and they're afraid I could prove. Ah, I said. I never regretted leaving the Foreign Ministry, but I was getting plenty more evidence to support my decision. Well, if it's any consolation, what you did resulted in exactly the desired result. Saguntum has accepted the protection of Cinnabar, and Karst has attacked us. Maeve smiled faintly. She said, I doubt that will make Under-Secretary Dowland any more willing to have his part in the matter become public. Her face suddenly shifted, looking younger and softer. Are you serious about letting me go, Roy? She said. Yes. What will happen to you when Lady Mundy comes back? I shrugged. I don't know, I said. Look, you were following orders. The reasoning behind the orders was solid. There were just things your superiors didn't know. You were doing exactly what I'd have done, and I won't leave you locked up for that, since for the moment it's my decision. I wondered if I'd be saying that if Maeve Grimaud looked like a pig instead of being the sexiest woman I'd ever met. I'm not saying she was prettier than Monica, and I'm certainly not saying that I could imagine wanting to spend more than maybe a half hour at a time with Maeve. What I just said was true regardless. I could look Lady Mundy in the eye and say it again, as I'd probably have to do. If you can get me out and get me my reticule back, Maeve said, I won't need any other help, even without the reticule. Let's see, I said. I went to the door and called, Sergeant Bernardi? I'm ready to leave, and I'd like to release Mistress Grimaud now. The sergeant came around the corner. He was smiling, but the patrol sling meant that his weapon was pointing at us as he approached. Is there something I need to sign? I asked. I'll have you read the request into my console, he said as he unlocked the cell and gestured us out. And Mistress Grimaud wants her purse out of storage, I added as we preceded the sergeant down the hall. If it's there, she can have it, he said. The purse was about big enough to hold a pair of eyeglasses. Maeve snatched it up. She didn't open it in front of me. Am I free to go? She asked, looking from me to the sergeant. Yes, I said. Sergeant Bernardi nodded. He looked at me and said, You can accept delivery of the purse too, sir. Maeve nodded. Thank you both, she said. She pressed the call button of the elevator. I went through the formalities of the console. The elevator arrived while I did that. It rose again with Maeve aboard. Sergeant Bernardi looked at me and said, I hope you know what you're doing, sir. Then he grinned and added, I guess I'd do the same if I was your age. Hell, I guess I would now. Chapter 41 Things settled into a pattern over the next few days. Our car only held four comfortably, and I came to trust my crew. Here in Jacquerie, I mean. In space, I'd trust them implicitly under any circumstances. I decided quickly that they weren't going to cause a real incident on the ground either, but that wasn't the same thing. For small facilities that didn't require any special expertise, I took only one spacer with me when I made the inspection. 6 days after the flotilla had left, Weddell and I were at the tracking and guidance station in the Genevieve Mountains. Our arrival had doubled the number of people present. Belky, one of the techs based there, was awake when we drove up. Our voices woke the other, Sackerson, though he was pretty clearly hungover. And why not? The station was a belt-and-suspenders backup for Jacquerie Control. The telemetry antennas here, on a high ridge 100 miles north of the capital, had a broader sweep of the heavens than those in the harbor. But the harbor array was perfectly adequate for the amount of traffic that Saguntum got. There was a dedicated line from here to the harbor, and there was a microwave antenna which could be switched to any target at line of sight. This was precisely the sort of facility I'd expected when I decided that most of the crew could have the day off. I was simply checking off boxes for my report to Captain Leary. I plugged my portable, luggable terminal into a socket on the local console, sending my report to Sunray to be stored. Sacristan suddenly said, "Say, that's funny." I paused as I started to insert my personal key into the terminal. I said, "What is?" "Well, there's 3 ships orbiting," Sacristan said. Belky came and joined him. "They're not responding to queries from control, and their transponders are turned off. But they are communicating with a ground station that isn't part of our network." I finished connecting my own terminal. The key gave me unlimited access to all government sites, a necessity for my liaison job. I called, "Weddle, be ready to move. This doesn't look good." "Bloody hell," Belky said. "One of them's dropping out of orbit, but they don't have approval to land." I linked to the primary array at Jackery Harbor and tried a trick that Corey had taught me after explaining that he'd learned it from Lady Mundy. The vessel landing had switched off its identification transponder, but it was a large ship and carried a pinnace with interstellar capacity as well as a pair of lifeboats limited to normal space. The attached vessels had their own transponders. When queried, the pinnace told me that it was aboard the Kurfürstendamm, which a landing control database told me was a 12,000-ton transport home-ported on the Alliance world of Stryker. Aloud, I said, "I believe Jackery is about to be attacked, and I'm very much afraid..." Still using the Jackery transceiver, I checked one of the ships still in orbit. It didn't have a lesser ship on board, but it was carrying 71 missiles which duly reported that they were embarked on the Erich Kollner, a modern, powerful Alliance destroyer. I sent a note to everybody in my electronic circle. "Alliance attacking Jackery, estimate 2,000 troops. That was based on the load capacity of the Kurfürstendamm. Escort, 2 destroyers. I shut down my terminal and rose. "Weddle," I said to my companion, "you and I are heading for the training facility at Gironde, where we were a few days ago." To the technicians, I continued, "I think you guys will be fine here, or as well off as anywhere, but we spacers need to drop out of sight in Gironde. Good luck, and I hope you'll wish us the same." "What's happening?" Belky said to our backs. I ignored him. I turned the car around in a plume of dust. The access road was paved, but the parking area beside the station was not. "Sir?" Weddle said when we were moving. "Why is it we're going to Gironde?" "We're not," I said, "but I hope to keep the other side in the dark for a while about where we are going." I thought about it and decided she had a right to know. As we got on the pavement, I said, "It appears that Saguntum is at war with the Alliance, and I'm very much afraid that we are at war with the Alliance also." Despite everything that Six and Lady Mundy had assured me. Well, as I said before, that was above my pay grade. Weddle and I didn't really talk until I passed the intersection with the road to Bevedere, the one we'd have taken if we'd really been going to Gironde. Then she said, "Sir, if that ship landing is attacking Jackery, why didn't the missiles engage it?" "They tried," I said. My quick scan of my terminal had given me enough data to figure out the Alliance attack plan. The batteries didn't take the commands from Jackery control. Either the battery crews have been bribed or somebody's locked out the centralized control. I'd done just that on Salam. It hadn't been difficult, but the batteries in Jackery were protected by my ability to get in. I'd tried just for the hell of it. Even with the access key on my terminal, I couldn't enter the missile director. I was sure it could be done, probably by somebody like Corey, certainly by Lady Mundy. But that meant that we weren't just facing Alliance troops. The security services, probably including the 5th Bureau, reporting to Guarantor Pora himself, were involved also. "Look, Weddle," I said, "I know Captain Leary put me in charge, but he wasn't expecting things to blow up the way they have. I've got a pretty screwy idea that's likely to get us killed, even if it works. You sure you want to stick with me?" Weddle turned toward me. I kept my eyes on the road, but I could see her from the corners of them. "Six put you in charge," she said. "What part of that do you think I don't understand? And if you're afraid I'm going to run and hide if the shooting starts, don't be. I was a cacique." "I don't think that," I said truthfully. "But I just thought..." I swallowed before I could think of the right word. "I thought I ought to ask. Well, you were bloody wrong, Weddle said, though she sounded good-humored. That's not how the RCN works, sir. Now, what are we going to do? There's a military prison on the north side of Jacquerie, I said. It's just off the road we're on now, and I'm hoping taking it over isn't high on the invader's to-do list. If Weddle had backed out, I'd have had an excuse to back out myself, except that I wouldn't have. I laughed out loud. The people from the Karst residency are held there, I said. I'm hoping their luggage is too, because that'll make the next part a lot simpler. We'll shoot our way into the military harbor if we have to, but I've got something else in mind. If I hadn't had the exact distance to the prison driveway, turn right off the north road onto Custis Road, 312 meters, I'd have missed it. A band of bushy local trees screened the double fences completely, and from the road the guard towers weren't visible over the vegetation. The place was obvious after we curved down the drive, but not before. Two guards were at the gatehouse. Instead of coming out to ask my business, one of them called, "Who are you?" His partner thrust a carbine through the gatehouse window. "I'm Colonel Folliot's aide," I shouted, "and if your buddy doesn't point his gun somewhere else, he's going to regret it." The outer gate opened so that I could drive in. The fellow who'd spoken before leaned out and said, "What the hell's going on, sir?" His partner was looking over his shoulder. The carbine had vanished. "Karst is invaded," I said, displaying the fancy document holder that Colonel Folliot had made up for me. "I'm here to help stop them." Explaining that it was really the Alliance wouldn't help me. For that matter, Karst probably was involved in this. "What are we supposed to do?" the other guard asked nervously. "Your jobs, of course," I said, "and start with letting us through to see your CO. The inner gate slid aside. "Chantal's already left," the first guard said. "I think Sergeant Busoni's in charge." "Then I'll see Sergeant Busoni," I said as I drove through. The administration building was brick and of one story. Running deeper from the back were a pair of two-story blocks of pinkish structural plastic with barred windows. They were separately fenced and wired. I didn't think the facility would hold more than 100 or so prisoners in single-occupancy cells, but my business wasn't with the occupants anyway. The only vehicle in front of the building was a six-wheeled bus painted light tan with the stenciled legend, "Army of Saguntum." Though there were half a dozen other spaces, I deliberately parked in the one marked "Commandant" and got out. "Do I come with you?" Weddle asked. "Yes," I said, simply to make a decision. I didn't care where she was, but I didn't want to discuss it. A heavy man, hell, he was fat, had risen behind the counter as we walked to the glass doors. I held out my identification in my left hand and said, "Sergeant, Colonel Folliot has sent me to get some items from the personality of the Karst prisoners. Take us to the storage area, please." "I can't do that," the sergeant said. I suppose he was the Busoni the guard at the gate had mentioned. He didn't move. "Then take us to somebody who can," I said. I was letting my voice be sharp, but I didn't raise it. "The only guy who can do that is Commandant Chantal," the sergeant said. His eyes were glazed and he was sweating. He left. "Look, you dickhead," Weddle shouted, leaning across the counter. "You may want to be shot for a bloody traitor after Karst gets sorted, but we don't. We're going to get what the colonel sent us for, with you or without. Which is it going to be?" "I don't have a key to the padlock," the sergeant said. I was afraid he was going to start crying. "Well, you've got a tool chest, don't you?" I said. "Or your maintenance people do. Take us there now. We're okay for the moment, but I don't know how long that'll last." The sergeant led us down the hall to his right to a door marked "Maintenance." It was locked, but I kicked it open while Busoni fished for a key. I'd hoped for bolt cutters, but settled for a large screwdriver to use as a pry bar. I noticed as we followed the sergeant through the door at the end of the hall that Weddle had brought a short-hafted, cross-peen hammer. A heavy metal shipping container stood against the side of the building, overlooked by one of the confinement blocks. A solid-looking padlock closed the outer double doors. I was looking for the best way to use my screwdriver when Weddle said, "Let me take a shot at it, sir." "All right," I said, and stepped out of the way. I didn't see how she could knock the lock off, but she seemed confident. Weddle measured the distance with her eyes, then brought the back of the hammer around in a sudden blow. The narrow peen hit the top of the lock barrel squarely, without touching either the hasp or the rings which it locked. There was a loud crash from the container itself. The lock sprang open. Weddle grinned as I pulled open the outer doors, and then the single inner panel. She said, "A rigger gets used to quick and dirty ways of doing things, sir." Thank heaven I didn't tell her to stay in the car, I thought. In the steel container were a score of fiberboard boxes, a meter long and about half that wide and deep. They were numbered in red, but there were no names on the outside. Are all of these from the car's prisoners? I asked Busoni.
Yeah, he said. Normally prisoners don't have anything outside the cells, but these are prisoners of war. They hauled the container in and filled it with the boxes they took from where they were captured.
Then let's start opening, I said, hauling a box onto the ground and thrusting my screwdriver between the top and the side before twisting. Staples gave way and allowed me to pry the top up. Weddle had a sturdy folding knife and got to work beside me. The sergeant watched us, bemused. On my third box, I found what I was looking for, the contents of Director McKinnon's closets. As I expected, there was a full military dress uniform in bright blue fabric, complete with saucer hat. If I remembered what I'd heard about Karst insignia, the silver triangles marked him as a full colonel. I'd have to wear my own footgear, soft black boots, suitable for wear within a vacuum suit, but they would pass. Sergeant, I said as I straightened, we've got what we came for. If you put the clothes back into the container and close it, you shouldn't have any trouble with the troops who arrive, unless you mention our visit. If you tell them about us, you'll have a lot of questions to answer, and they won't be best pleased that you don't have answers for them. Weddle and I headed back to the car. Behind us, Busoni meeped.
Hey, it's not right you leaving this mess for me.
You drive, I said to Weddle. I'll change in the back seat. How about my clothes, she asked. She was wearing RCN utilities, mottled gray and loose. You'll pass for my driver, I said as we got into the vehicle.
You don't look Saguntine. Remember, we're dealing with Alliance Army, not fleet personnel.
We headed off toward the harbor facilities. McKinnon and I were similar height, but he was heavier from 30 years of office work. I wondered if I'd live another 30 years. Weddle wasn't a good driver, but there were fewer people than usual on the streets of Jacquerie, and very, very few cars. I wondered if the invaders had ordered people to stay inside, or if folks had just decided it was good sense to do so. I could see people watching past skewed shutters, but nobody called to us. We didn't run into any patrols, police or military either. Instead of going directly to the naval barracks, I had Weddle drive us to a public works motor pool, which was more or less on the way. A frightened-looking watchman let us in, but the regular staff had fled. A dozen small tractors and scores of wheeled garbage hoppers were parked within a wire-fenced yard. The only permanent improvement was a small shed, but it had a connection to the government system. I connected my terminal while Weddle and the watchman fidgeted nearby. The barracks didn't have active imagery, but the dart sloops floating in the harbor adjacent had sensor packs on their spines. The naval buildings and the frontage of the military harbor had always been fenced off from the rest of Jacquerie. The Alliance forces were reinforcing the woven wire barrier with rolls of concertina wire at the base. Judging from the preparations going on, they planned to add more on top of the original fence. Instead of a single member of the shore police, a squad of Alliance troops in battle dress guarded the gate. Teams of four were stationed at front and back of the naval barracks, while Alliance engineers fenced it off from the rest of the enclosure. The invaders were apparently using the barracks as a prison, at least for the time being. Well, I said to Weddle, it isn't going to get easier. There's room to park on Water Street near the gate. Let's go do that. The watchman stared as we went back to the car. It was a half mile to drive from the lot down to the harbor entrance. We could have walked the two short, steep blocks more quickly. I preferred the look of arriving by vehicle, however. It would have been better yet if we'd had a limousine instead of a cramped little beater, though I figured we'd be all right. Maybe next time I could ask Hogg for an upgrade in case we had to do something like this again. We pulled up just short of the gateway. I'd been riding beside Weddle in the front. The back seats were all right for legroom, but the roof there brushed the top of my head, even though I wasn't much above average height, 5'10" if I got the benefit of the doubt. The guards watching us through the wire wore a uniform pattern I'd never seen before. Green on green on green, all the shades dull, and carried stocked impellers of an unfamiliar pattern. These threw lighter projectiles than the standard-issue weapons I was used to. Dad had handled small arms, though it was a minor part of his business. "I'm Colonel McKinnon of the Karst Security Service," I said to the officer on the other side of the wire. "We're here to pick up one of my agents, who was caught with the unit he was observing." I held up the bifold from McKinnon's effects, with text and photo on one side and a hexagonal platinum badge on the other. The picture looked as much like me as these ever do, and the text, which indicated I was 53, was unreadable without concentration or a magnifier. "I haven't had any orders about this," the officer said. He frowned. His cap badge was an R on crossed lightning bolts. These must be local auxiliaries, the sort of unit Saguntum might provide if my survey was satisfactory.
Well, get them, I said. I don't know who you report to. I talked to an aide to Major Wittgenstein of the 5th Bureau, and believe me, you don't want him to have to sort this. I pulled Wittgenstein's name out of my arse. I didn't figure a low-ranking reserve officer would have any better idea of who commanded the Alliance Security Detachment than I did. The threat was perfectly believable, though. Just tell them that Colonel McKinnon wants to remove an agent from the general captured population before his fellows realize that he's a traitor who's been helping us, I said. The officer had a portable phone the size of a shoebox. He dutifully began making calls, trying to get somebody to take responsibility for something he didn't understand well enough to explain. He had no more luck than you'd expect. The other guards were staring at the man, which probably bothered him as much as Weddle and I did. After 2 minutes, which I'm sure seemed like more to the officer, I said, "Bloody hell, man. One wog more or less doesn't matter. But if you get an agent killed and he's working for the 5th Bureau, you might as well eat your gun now. It'll be quicker and a lot less painful." I'm pretty sure that a real Karst security official would be less overbearing with Alliance troops, but it seemed to me what the job required here. If this fellow had been a long-service regular, I wouldn't have tried it with him, and I suspect I'd have been coughing up my teeth if I had. "Oh, go get him, then," the officer said petulantly, breaking his connection. He seemed to have been on hold anyway. Then, to one of his men, "Let them in." Weddle and I sauntered through the pedestrian door. The way the barbed wire had been laid meant that they couldn't have opened the vehicular gate if they'd wanted to. The quartet of guards at the front of the barracks watched us come. I said to the oldest, "We're here to pick up a prisoner. Whitlake goes by Red." "The lieutenant," I nodded toward the man who'd let us in, he was probably a lieutenant, "cleared it with your headquarters." "We got a Whitlake?" the man I'd spoken to asked the fellow beside him who'd taken out a data unit. "Yeah, room 3, ground floor," that man said. Rather than go inside, the older soldier walked closer to the building and shouted, "Whitlake, get your ass out here now." The windows were open, but I still wasn't sure how well that was going to work until the front door suddenly opened. Whitlake stepped out, looking worried and glancing over his shoulder. "This way, Spacer," I said, "and get moving." "Sir?" Whitlake said, gaping. "No talking now," I ordered brusquely. "We'll discuss your assignment aboard Elcano." I noted to the guards. "Thank you, men," I said. I hadn't counted on being in time. With the Saguntine darted between us, Weddle and I walked down the quay to where Elcano was berthed. Some of the Alliance troops may have wondered about what was going on, but they didn't say anything aloud. Chapter 42. Whitlake started to say something as we strode along, but I snapped, "Don't talk to her in the ship." Nobody was nearby, and I wasn't sure there was even a parabolic microphone on the planet, but I wanted to have my discussion with the darter in a controlled, confined space. The sloop's boarding ramp felt solid after the quivering nervousness of the extension. As soon as we were in the hold, I used the local switch to start the hatch closing. On the bridge, I brought the console up, glanced at the readouts, reaction mass had been topped off, another mark in Lieutenant Smith's favor, and started the internal pump cycling. Then I rotated the couch inward and grinned up at Whitlake, who stood nervously beside Weddle. "Red," I said, "you asked me for another chance when you funked it on Karst. This is your chance if..." "Yes, sir," Whitlake said. "Red, you really do have a choice here," I said. "I'll put you off and act as my own darter unless you're sure you can do it." "Sir, I'm better than you'll ever be," Whitlake said, leaning forward. "I can do this. You said you were giving me a chance, so stop talking and let's bloody get on with it." "Yes, all right," I said. "Take your stations. We'll lift off, insert, and then extract to make our attack. We'll all be in suits, but Red, you won't be going out on the hull. Weddle and I will take care of the rig. And I'll say right now, if there's a bad problem with the rig, I'll reprogram and keep trying till I'm happy about where we're going to extract. We're not in a rush to do this, but we're only going to get one chance, understood?" Weddle shrugged. Whitlake said, "Yes, sir." "Then let's get our suits on," I said. We all went to the locker. The 3 rigging suits that Captain Leary had sent to Elcano, from commercial suppliers, I'd noticed, were still aboard. Weddle and I each donned one, but I was pleased to agree when Red asked if he could wear an air suit. He might be marginally less safe, but he'd certainly be more effective as a darter in less uncomfortable gear. I wasn't ruthless enough to order Red to wear the lighter suit, but I didn't try to argue him out of it. In all truth, I didn't think any of us were likely to survive. Elcano had only 4 plasma thrusters. I tested them in diagonal pairs,
bringing each set up to half power with the sphincter pedals flared. The sloop rocked unpleasantly, and the external view fogged to sparkling gray as the steam rose to blanket the sensors on the spine.
"Elkanah to control," I called on the local VHF frequency. "Elkanah lifting to test new high drive installation as scheduled."
"Over. Break.
Ship, prepare for liftoff."
I ran the thrusters at full, then reduced the sphincters to minimum aperture. The sloop paused in a ball of steam, then began to lift in her leisurely fashion. The 6 high drive motors gave the sloops considerable agility and vacuum, but their thrusters were the minimum necessary to get them to orbit. I wondered whether the personnel in Saguntum Control were all from the Alliance, or if the regular Saguntine crew was on duty with Alliance guards. The only ships in orbit at present were the 2 destroyers, so I wasn't worried about an ordinary movement problem. It was possible that the missile batteries had been restored to function. I'd been afraid to check in case I called attention to them and to me. I hoped that if we sounded normal, nobody would panic and gut us on the way up.
"Elkanah, you are clear to lift,"
Control responded through the RF hash from the thrusters.
"Out."
We were already lifting, but that was good to know. So far, so good. I'd timed the ascent to avoid as much as possible the destroyers already above the planet. I hoped they would ignore us so long as we appeared to be ignoring them. But the Medus hailed us as we rose through 100,000 feet.
"Saguntine ship, this is Hegemony vessel, Medus. Return to Jackery Haven at once. No vessels are permitted to leave Saguntum during the present emergency. Acknowledge, over."
Instead of switching propulsion modes as I normally would at that height, I engaged the high drive but left the thrusters running at maximum output. We had plenty of reaction mass for this operation. What we might not have was time. As our acceleration more than doubled, I switched to tight beam microwave and said,
"Medus, this is Sloop Elkanah, now under Alliance control. We are cleared to test our high drive motors, which have been recently replaced. Repeat, we have clearance from Jackery control. Elkanah, over."
Although Elkanah was a naval vessel, its plot position indicator was rudimentary compared to what I had trained on at the academy. The Colner and Medus were red and orange beads, respectively, at the head of thin tracks of the same color. But the console didn't automatically predict those tracks in the future. We were higher than the Medus and continued to rise, but her orbital course continued to close the distance.
"Elkanah, you must land immediately or you will be destroyed," the Medus ordered. "Respond and obey immediately. Over."
I focused my optical sensors on the Karst destroyer. She was underway, starting to lift out of orbit to pursue us. That was alarming enough, but even worse, her dorsal turrets were rising out of their locked position. The Medus had been prepared to land. Now she was coming to action stations.
"Roger, Medus," I said, ignoring the way Whitlock moved in his seat to stare at me past my holographic screen. "We are shutting down to return to Jackery Haven. Elkanah out."
"You mean we're not going to attack?" Whitlake asked through the console. Instead of replying directly, I said,
"Ship, prepare to insert."
I shut down the thrusters and the high drive. Both means of propulsion released ions, which made it impossible to balance the ship's charge to enter the matrix.
"Inserting," I said as I executed.
We made a smooth transition. I gave a great sigh of relief and set the rig to deploy. Heaven knew how much of it really would rise without human help.
"Weddle," I said, "you'll need to go out by yourself for the time being."
I sketched out a course while we were on the ground, but the Medus forced us to insert way early, out of place, and with less sidereal velocity than I'd planned for.
"Roger," she said, getting up from the bunk.
She walked to the airlock with her helmet in her hand.
"Red," I said, "we're going to attack just like we planned. I lied to the Medus so they wouldn't start shooting at us. Even a near miss would change our surface charge enough that we wouldn't be able to insert until we'd rebalanced it. We're safe as long as we stay in the matrix."
I shrugged.
"Now," I said, "we won't be able to move very far when we started out at such a low speed. On the other hand, we don't need to move very far. We'll be extracting very close to where we inserted. But we'll be coming back from a vector I hope they don't expect, right?"
The Saguntine darter nodded to me.
"Right," he said. "I'll be ready."
He was making an effort to sound enthusiastic. That was good enough. Certainly, it was as good as I could manage myself right now. Elkanah rang as Weddle closed the outer hatch of the airlock. I got to working, plotting our new course through the matrix. The sloop's limited rig, 4 antennas with only main and foresails, meant there was less to go wrong than a more maneuverable ship would have, but the dorsal antenna wasn't fully vertical, and the port main yard hadn't even begun to rotate into place. I considered joining Weddle despite what I'd said, but then the telltale indicated the dorsal had locked. The hydromechanical indicators were touchy. The antenna itself may have been fine all along. I resumed work on the course. I'd planned to attack the Meduse, but I couldn't predict her location. The likelihood was that when Elcano disappeared, the Meduse had stopped accelerating outward. She might be anywhere in a sphere of too large a volume for me to plot an attack. That left the Eric Kollner. There was a reasonable chance that she would hold her orbit, in which case putting Elcano in an attack position would be just a question of my skill. Though the Kollner was the only option as a target, there were several downsides. The Alliance destroyer mounted heavier plasma cannon, quite heavy in fact, 12.5-centimeter weapons. In addition, and probably worse, the Alliance crew would show a higher state of training than that of the Karst crew, and they were more likely to be alert. There wasn't any choice. I worked on my course. We shunted through four separate bubble universes. At each transition, I rechecked the course according to the actual sail plan, as it varied from the intended plan. The rig seemed to be loosening up with use. There were no serious misalignments after we made the final shift, so the attack should go in as I planned it. If my calculations were right, and if the Kollner had held its same orbit. I called Weddle in from the hull. I felt bad about not having gotten out to help her, though she clearly was capable of handling the job. My calculations had been more complex than I'd expected, both because of the initial problems with the rig and because I was so very aware of the fact that I had to get it right this time. Rechecking wouldn't necessarily catch my errors. It hadn't when we attacked Karst. It was the only thing I knew to do, however, so that's what I did. Weddle re-entered the cabin, holding her helmet under her arm. "It's all solid, sir," she called. "I was worried about the port main spar, but it only hung up the first time. It's been right as rain since." "Ship," I said, using the PA system, but with the propulsion system shut down in the matrix, I wouldn't have had to. "We'll extract in 3 minutes. Red, launch when you bear. Over." Weddle nodded and settled onto her bunk. Whitlake, running the console simulation of the Eric Kollner, nodded but didn't speak. For want of anything better to do, I began plotting a course to Benedict. Succeed or fail, Elcano couldn't very well land again on Saguntum. It made very little sense to plot so distant an escape course, but I preferred doing that rather than watching a clock read down. When my screen pulsed pink to alert me, I switched the console to current sensor data. There was none, so the display was an opalescent cloud and said, "Ship, prepare for extraction in 5 seconds. Extracting? Now." We extracted into normal space. I felt my bones freezing as the display came into sharp focus. The Kollner was exactly where the console had predicted it would be if I'd done my astrogation correctly. I was reaching to engage the high drive motors when a plasma bolt hit the starboard antenna. The mainsail diffused it slightly, but the heavy steel tubing caught most of the energy and slammed Elcano. We lurched. The second bolt hit the ventral topsail and yard. The Kollner had registered the disruption to sidereal space caused by a ship extracting from the Matrix. She'd begun firing before Elcano even existed in the normal universe. 4 of her heavy cannon could be brought to bear on our predicted location, and the last 2 bolts met us when we appeared. My display fogged. Vaporized metal from the rig had recondensed on the sensor pickups. If the first bolt hadn't jerked us out of our original alignment, the second would have struck us straight on in the bow. A jolt and a roar, not another plasma bolt, but Elcano's weapon launching. "Dart away," Whitlake shouted. "We got the bastard." The third bolt hit the underside of our port outrigger and spun the sloop like a flipped coin. The Kollner's big guns were slower firing than the 4-inch weapons which the RCN standardized for destroyers, but she got in that one additional round. Our hull was leaking. Whipping when the outrigger was ripped away had started seams. My helmet was clipped onto the couch fitting intended for the purpose. I donned and latched it before the pressure had dropped to the level where riggers in the airlock going out would bother. My first job after getting the helmet on was to correct our spin. The third hit had vaporized most of the outrigger. The bubble of gaseous steel had acted like a sudden rocket burn driving us clockwise. I engaged the motors on the starboard outrigger, giving them a 5-second burn. I was afraid to overcorrect because I had no way to deal with a counterclockwise rotation. The portside motors had vanished with the outrigger on which they'd been mounted. The Kollner fired twice more while we spun. The plasma bolts appeared as glowing tracks in the glimpses I got of the screen. Neither of them came close. The damage we'd taken had flung us out of any predictable path. My finger poised to try another tiny burn. I wondered if the destroyer would continue firing at us when the captain realized that Elcano was harmless junk. I guess they would. Gunners don't get much chance to use their weapons, and the sloop was a real live-fire exercise. I tapped the manual execute icon. As I did so, the Eric Kollner turned inside out, scattering bits of itself and its crew like a slow-motion piñata. Our dart, Whitlake's dart, had gutted it like a fish. "Sir! Sir!" Whitlake was shouting. "I did it! I really did it!" I heard the words. He was shouting them into a two-way link formed by the word "sir." But I wasn't really connecting them with the wreck of the Alliance destroyer. Some of the Kollner's crew must have survived. Riggers suited to go out on the hull, damage crews standing by to glue sheeting over torn seams and to pinch off ruptured hydraulic lines. Many of those drifting figures must be shouting in hope and terror. But I couldn't hear them. I couldn't hear anything from outside our cabin, not even static. I brought up the communication screen. There was nothing, zero, on any of the media. Long wave to microwave radio, modulated laser, anything. We were cut off from all forms of communication. I stared at the debris spreading from what had been the Eric Kollner. They at least could call for help. "Come on, Weddle," I said. "Let's go out and fix what's wrong with our commo suite." Weddle and I went out together, leaving Whitlake at the console, viewing over and over the logged moment when the dart struck the Kollner just starboard of her central axis and quartered through the ship. The fusion bottle didn't vent, but that honestly couldn't have increased the damage much beyond what the dart had done to her as it was. Red had every right to be proud. So did the Kollner's gunners, as I saw even before I stepped out onto our hull. The airlock was on the port side. We had to push the outer hatch open with our shoulders, not because of warping as I'd first thought, but because a mist of gaseous steel had cooled over everything facing what had been the port outrigger. The coating was as smooth and even as the layers of a pearl. I suppose that steel similarly coated the commo suite, a blister on the port bow, but the problem there was even simpler. A chunk of outrigger, still solid, had shaved off the blister in a 6x3-foot patch of Elcano's outer hull. If the angle had been slightly different, it would have come through the bridge and carried most of both me and the console out the other side. There was nothing to fix about the commo suite, it was just gone. I took a look at the plasma thrusters. The starboard pair was apparently all right. The portside thrusters were problematic. The sphincter pedals were bright with redeposited steel, which would keep them from opening and closing initially, but during use the stellite leaves should burn clean in seconds or at worst a minute or two. Weddle had been looking over the rig. I signaled her to join me back in the cabin. We still had to keep our helmets on, but it was marginally more comfortable. The proper leads would have permitted us to speak through the console, but Elcano didn't have them. We were helmet to helmet inside as well, but without the risk of colliding with drifting debris. "How's the rig?" I asked Weddle. "Starboard may retract," she said. I'm sure she was shrugging in her rigging suit. "What's left of dorsal ought to be easy to cut away. Port is torn bad, but it'll be a bitch to cut the rest of the way. Maybe as bad as if it was still as installed. And ventral, I'd say we're screwed. All the joints are plated. It'll take days to cut. Explosive would be better. But we don't have any aboard, do we?" "No explosives that I know about," I said, also shrugging. "I'm going to see if I can angle the thrusters to counterbalance the surviving high-drive motors. I'll retract the outrigger if I can. That'll help." Whitlake leaned forward from the striker seat to tap me on the leg for attention. He pointed enthusiastically to the display, then settled back to continue watching on his own reduced screen. Weddle and I shifted to see what was happening on the main display. Default on a military display was to carrot movement. So even with degraded optics, I could pick up not only the ship nearing orbit, but the one that was rising through the atmosphere. I touched a control and a legend appeared next to either ship in a contrasting color. They were the Magellanes and the Lezo, respectively. Whitlake shouted something I couldn't hear. I didn't need the words to understand his delight. As he spoke, a third carrot appeared, when our surviving sensors could distinguish the ship from the military harbor from which it rose. The legend Concha confirmed my expectation. I shouted and slapped my thigh. The gauntlet cracked sharply on the stiffened plate of the rigging suit. "By heavens," I shouted to myself. If they know what they're doing, they'll handle the Medus, even though she's on the alert. The trouble was, as I saw at once, the sloop's crews didn't know what they were doing. They weren't extending their antennas to enter the matrix and come at the destroyer from unpredictable directions. A destroyer with skilled crew, knowing what to look for, could pick up the disruption of sidereal space for up to 10 seconds before a ship extracts from the matrix. Eric Kollner had done that, and we'd been lucky that her plasma bolts hadn't detonated our DART's fuel before Whitlake was able to launch. The Medusa's crew probably wasn't that good, and the Karst vessel might not even have had sufficient sensor discrimination to do that. The sloops were surrendering their greatest advantage by coming straight in. In addition, the sails protected the target's hull from gunfire once. Plasma bolts loosed all their energy on the first object they hit. All the Medusa had to do was to keep at a distance and to fire at the sloops until the darts exploded, or the darters launched them beyond burnout range. When a dart's fuel was expended in vacuum, it no longer had any homing ability. The Medusa was accelerating. I think the Karst captain initially planned to engage the Magellanes. When a second sloop joined her, with a third rising behind them, the plan must have changed. The Medusa was accelerating not only at the best rate her high drive could manage, but for over a minute, with the plasma thrusters burning also. Her drive shut down. "I swear," my lips said. But what my mind was really thinking was, "Pray heaven." The destroyer faded from our display as she inserted into the matrix. The Medusa's captain had watched one dart sloop destroy an Alliance vessel that was more powerful and better crewed than his own. Here were three more sloops. The Medusa was running rather than face them. I hugged Weddle, and Whitlake sprang up to join us. Space above Saguntum was now firmly in the control of the Saguntum Naval Defense Force. I looked at the display again to see whether any of the sloops were shaping toward us. We had no way to communicate with anybody. Whitlake slapped me on the shoulder and pointed into the holographic display, disrupting it until he took his hand away. I looked at the planet again instead of toward the sloops. A fourth vessel was rising from the military harbor. She was the Alfraz. I cheered myself hoarse. Chapter 43. After the first rush of relief, "I'm not going to die when the air runs out," I realized that I had more work to do. Using the thrusters with the petals flared open, I managed to kill our spin completely. I'd gotten close enough with the high drive that there was no discomfort to the crew, but if we were going to transfer to another ship, it'd be a lot better if we were dead still. I had another concern, that I wouldn't have spoken aloud even if it had been easier to communicate while wearing suits. I didn't trust the ship-handling skills of whoever was crewing the Alfraz. It was possible that somebody in the Saguntine force was expert, but there was no reason any of them should be. As for the Sunrays, Gamba might have played with ship-handling, but ordinary riggers wouldn't have. Generally, warrant officers had some experience conning small boats, but they'd all gone off with Captain Leary. Weddle attached a full air bottle and went back out on the hull. I stuck at the console in case there was something I could do. I could maneuver Elcano to a degree, but I didn't intend to do so since I had no means of communication with our rescuers. The Alfraz swelled slowly on my display. I half expected her to collide with us, but tiny blooms from her thrusters damped her motion perfectly. She hung alongside us, so close that we'd have touched if our dorsal antenna had been full length. I could see three spacers on the hull. There was a clang, felt through my boots, not heard in the vacuum, as a magnetic grapple locked on. Weddle moved into the field of my optics and proceeded up the line arm after arm. I tapped Whitlake on the shoulder and pointed to the airlock. It was time for us to be going also. I put Whitlake on the line ahead of me and waited till his magnetic boots were on the hull of the Alfraz before I followed him. Mixon gripped me and motioned our helmets together. "Anybody else?" he asked. "Just the three of us," I said. He gestured the three of us to the airlock, and with his fellow Sunrays began coiling up the grapnel after cutting the power to release it. Three people, two of them in rigging suits, was about capacity for the Alfraz's lock, so I didn't argue the point. We had our helmets off when we stepped onto the bridge. The people greeting us were clinging to whatever each one could, since they weren't wearing boots with magnetic soles. I'd hoped Monica would be here, but I had to call "watch it" when she would have thrown herself into my arms. "There's metal fittings on this suit, and they're cold." It hadn't even crossed my mind that Maeve Grimaud might be aboard. She stood against the rear bulkhead, gripping the vertical support of a stack of bunks. She was smiling coolly and trying to look as though holding herself in place that way wasn't a strain. It was almost a surprise to see Lal seated at the console. "I have done this before, sir," he said, nodding politely. "I am glad to see you well." And of course, he'd maneuvered ships together in the past. It was a rare skill among honest spacers, but fairly common among pirates. "Lal," I said, "where did you come from?" "It was kind of your Captain Leary to offer me a place," he said. It seemed that such an excellent organization as the RCN, however, was not a suitable place for so humble a person as me. The sun rays came in from the hull, laughing about how well the operation had gone. "Hey, good to see you, sir," Gideon called. "When we heard what you'd done, we figured that was all she wrote for you. And pretty bloody close from the way the ship looks," Mixon said. "The Culner looks worse," I said. "Say, can we get underway now? Unless there's a problem, Lal, just bring us up to 1G. We'll worry about the course later." I finished getting my suit off a moment after the high drive kicked in to provide the equivalent of gravity. I turned to find Monica, but she was already beside me. The sun rays cheered as we kissed. Then she stepped back and with an unexpectedly serious look said, "Roy, you asked where Lal came from. Mistress Grimaud located him and convinced him to join us. And she really planned this whole operation, except what you did yourself." Maeve hadn't moved from where she stood, though her nonchalant appearance seemed a trifle more genuine now that she no longer had to grip the stanchion. She said, "I thought it was possible that my loyalty to Cinnabar might have been in doubt. I've tried to allay those doubts." "I didn't realize the two of you had met," I said, smiling brightly, and really wishing I weren't in the middle of this conversation. "Ah, Maeve," I thought of calling her Mistress Grimaud, but didn't. "I'm pretty sure that when this story gets back to Xenos, you'll find your superiors lining up to take credit for sending you to Saguntum." "One can only hope," Maeve said with a cold expression. Sir," said Cassidy, the big man in battle dress whom I'd met as Colonel Folliot's second in command. "I've got some wounded men, and I'd appreciate if we could get them to help sooner rather than later. If you could?"
"The temporary capital is at Borodine," Monica said. "It's on the other side of the Genovese, and you can land starships there. The Confirstendam brought armored vehicles as well as men, but Dad says he can block the passes if they try to move on Borodine."
"Sure, let's set down there," I said, "but wounded? Who?"
"Mistress Grimaud got the roadblock on Hollywell Street moved before we arrived," Monica said. "But Major Cassidy and a platoon of special police hidden in a furniture van were necessary to get us into the military harbor. They're on the couches in the hold. It was the best way to escape."
"Ah," I said. I was trying to decide what next to say when Lal got up from the console. "Captain," he said, "since you're here, would you care to land us? I would rather that you did." I settled behind the console. I had a lot of questions to ask, and I'd get around to them. Right now, though, I was glad to have a moderately challenging job to do that would prevent anybody from talking to me for an hour or so. Borodine was at a river mouth. It wasn't much of a place by itself, but the annotated charts said the river system drained most of the plain to the east of the Genevieve Mountains. The agricultural products, mostly grain, were taken to Jacquerie by sea on bulk carriers and loaded on starships there for export. Though Borodine wasn't a starport, it had plenty of sheltered water to land on, and better facilities than Salaam to serve any ships that did land. I'd figured to set down without landing control, but in fact the signal from Borodine was sharp and professional. That puzzled me as I started breaking us in. Then I remembered the station and microwave link in the mountains above us. Belky and Sacrison were earning their pay, possibly for the first time. A fire department isn't a waste of tax money, even if those assigned to it spend most of the time washing their cars. Harbor control brought us down on a spot not far from the surface docks. I let the console make the landing. I grinned as I recalled that the facilities here were a considerable step up from what we found when we first stopped to take on water after our escape from Salaam. To begin with, we weren't going to have a giant slug, or whatever the devil it had been, crawl aboard through the pump intake. We landed more smoothly than if we'd been in a proper harbor. Here, the waves our thrusters raised could expand at will across the broad estuary. Surface vessels and other starships, if there'd been any, there weren't at the moment, though I suppose the dart sloops would operate from here, would rock and pitch.
for the Alfraz didn't dance in her own violence reflected by the walls of a slip confining her. I shut down the thrusters. Lol went through the hatch to the hold, to drop our anchor, I suppose, though I'd have to send somebody else if I didn't hear